Hey there, I'm Mark Scarborough, and this is the podcast Walking with Dante, a podcast that is walking over reliefs in the roadbed on the Terrace of Pride. If that doesn't make any sense, or you don't know what purgatory is, or you don't know what purgatorio is inside of Dante's masterwork comedy, you might want to go back and catch previous episodes all the way back, hundreds of episodes back into Inferno, and catch up with us, or you can start here, although it's a weird place to start. We're at Purgatorio, Canto 12, lines 37 through 48, 12 more lines. Dante is looking at the carved reliefs in the roadbed of the Terrace of Pride. He's passed by some of the prideful who are underneath gigantic boulders, barely able to squat along the road, carrying these giant base pieces of art, the very fundamentals of art itself, huge stones, the fundamentals of statuary. He's seen those people. He's seen carvings in the side of the mountain that represent humility, and now he's seeing a bunch of carvings that represent those who have been prideful. We are in my English translation. You can find it on my website, markscarborough.com or walkingwithdante.com. You can read along, and better yet, you can continue the conversation with me there so that others can glean from your understanding of this passage. Oh, Niobe, with your sad eyes, I saw you carved into relief in the roadbed and set among your dead seven sons and seven daughters. Oh, Saul, what you looked like. You were thrown under your sword and dead at Gilboa, which never after had any rain or dew. Oh, crazy Arachne. I saw you morphing into a spider, pathetic, wound up in your own strands, the very work that brought you so much woe. Oh, Rehoboam, the image of you doesn't seem to be terrible, but rather to cower, for a chariot carries the thing off without anyone's giving it chase. Just like last time, I want to talk about who these figures are, Niobe, Saul, Arachne, Rehoboam. Then I want to talk a little bit about the art that's going on here. And then I want to bring you to a curiosity in that passage itself, and then more of that discussion about humility. So let's get going. Let's start with the first figure, Niobe. Oh, Niobe, with your sad eyes, I saw you carve into relief in the roadbed and set among your dead seven sons and seven daughters. This is Niobe, the daughter of Tantalus and Dione. She's the wife of Amphion, the king of Thebes. She was so proud of her many children that she claimed that Latona, one of the grand figures from mythology, had only had two children, Apollo and Diana. Well, Latona gets wind of Niobe's pride at her children. She encourages the killing of Niobe's children. The story is found in Ovid, the Metamorphoses, in Book 6, lines 182 and following along in there. It's an interesting story in that it is about pride. In fact, it seems to actually be connected to pride there. In Ovid, after the killing of her children, she turns into a marble statue that continues to cry for, I guess, all of eternity. That's Niobe with your sad eyes. That's that statue pouring out tears. And we should just think that statues are a loaded bit on the Terrace of Pride, both because of the penitents who are crawling underneath rocks, the base material of statues, and because of the intaglios and reliefs carved all over this Terrace of Pride itself. So that we have a statue here is intriguing, and there's a way that we can connect the pathos, do I want to say the pathos of Niobe here, with the first figure in the last episode or the last passage, who was Lucifer. There we had a kind of grandiose, heroic pride cast out of heaven. Here we have the after effects of a much more tragic pride, with progeny killed because of their mother's prideful state. It goes on from there to a biblical figure. Oh, Saul, what you look like. This is the first king of Israel. He's a rather common man by all accounts. He was chosen by God through Samuel, the prophet Samuel, and then he was also deposed or put down by God through the prophet Samuel. Saul disobeyed God. Saul had been told not to take any booty from one of his military campaigns. He did. This displeased God. God kicked him out of the kingship. Saul also goes mad in the text, and David's playing the harp calms Saul down. And Saul's son, Jonathan, is David's best friend. Remember David? He was in those intaglios, the second one, dancing in front of the ark. We have a callback here implicitly to the intaglios, but here we have Saul dead in a great battle. In fact, Saul dies. He runs on his sword. He asks actually his servant near Gilboa, which is in Samaria. He asks his servant to run him through. He refuses. The servant refuses. So Saul kind of falls on his own sword. David in 2 Samuel chapter 1 verses 21 right in there, or if you're following the Catholic Bible in 2 Kings chapter 1 verse 21, David gives a lament in which he laments the death of Saul and then says that basically the mountains around this region should never again sense rain or dew. So David is sitting in this passage. He's sitting underneath Saul. He's the next king after Saul, but also his poetry, No Rain or Dew, is sitting in this passage. And that poetry leads us out to Arachne. Oh, crazy Arachne. And there's that word phole, used of Ulysses. Oh, crazy Arachne. I saw you morphing into a spider, pathetic, wound up in your strands, the very work that brought you so much woe. If you don't know, this story is told in Ovid's Metamorphoses. We're still in book 6. We're at lines, about the start of book 6 through lines 140, 145, along in there. What happens is Arachne challenges Minerva to a competition. Who can weave the best tapestry? Arachne wins. She beats Minerva. It looks even better. She may make fun of the gods, or she may represent them more clearly, depending on how you read the passage and the various stories that get told even post-Ovid. Minerva gets furious and rips Arachne's tapestry to millions of threads, and Arachne then kills herself on those strands. She hangs herself. Here she's wound up in her strands, the very work from the tapestry that brought you so much woe. And we should just note that the third figure here is Arachne, who is traditionally associated with poetry, the weaver of webs, how poets work, as Arachne's work, weaving this web. And the third figure in the last set from the last episode of this podcast was Apollo. Poetry entered in at the third slot in both the god of poetry and a kind of metaphor or allegory for how poetry works. And it moves on to our last figure, Rehoboam. He's the son of Solomon. So we've come down to the deposed Saul, to the new King David, and then his son Solomon. And now we have Rehoboam, who's David's grandson. Rehoboam is born of an Ammonite princess. He takes over, and essentially what happens is there's a tax revolt that goes on. People are complaining about the amount of taxes they had to pay to make Solomon's temples and all the great shrines he built. They don't want to have such a huge burden anymore. They kind of get all up in arms about this thing, a kind of Israelite tea party of tax reform. And Rehoboam basically gets in his chariot and runs away. And it doesn't really seem that big a deal. No one gives him chase, and he goes running away. And this running away that he does, he is now the king after Solomon, splits Israel into two kingdoms, the northern 10 tribes, at least as told in the story, and the southern 2 tribes, Judah and Benjamin. This is the splitting of the kingdom of Israel itself from David's great domains. Let's look at the artistry of this passage. Before we get to the next part of this podcast, let me say it would be great if you could help support this podcast. I have hosting fees, licensing fees, editing fees. I pay royalties for the sound effects. I have streaming fees, domain name fees. It all comes to quite a bit. Many of you have stepped up to the plate, and I can't thank you enough. I wish that I could sit here and list all of you who have given money, but I feel that this is also a violation of privacy. So just know that I've tried to connect with you in email, and I've tried to thank you personally, and I'm thanking you here for it. If you would like to help consider underwriting this podcast, there's a PayPal link both in the player and on my website, markscarborough.com or walkingwithdante.com. You can find the link there for PayPal, and you can donate anything you wish. And let's go on with the reliefs underneath our feet. Now let's look at how this thing is put together. In the last passage, we had a chiasmus. We remember we had a biblical figure, a classical figure, a bunch of classical figures, and then a bunch of biblical figures. This time, we just have an alteration. We have a classical figure, Niobe, then a biblical figure, Saul, then a classical figure, Arachne, then a biblical figure, Rehoboam. The statue of Niobe is an art form, a statue. The first classical reference is to something that became a piece of art, a statue, Niobe, in her Metamorphoses. The second tercet, Saul, is about politics and the way that politics are an arena of pride and do people in. Then we're back to art with Arachne and the weaving of the tapestry. And then we're back to politics with the biblical figure of Rehoboam. You'll also notice that in the initial one, Niobe, she's a morphed figure out of the Metamorphoses, and then we have a tragic figure, Saul, and then we have a morphing figure. She's morphing into the spider even as he looks on. So morphed, tragic, morphing, and then the final stop here is Rehoboam, and the language used is wild. A chariot carries off the thing without anyone giving it chase. It's that the thing bit. It's almost like Rehoboam is dehumanized at the end. He may be the final metamorphosis in the passage, that politics and art are about metamorphoses, but finally, if pride gets involved, it dehumanizes the figure. You'll also notice that Niobe is a boasting figure, Saul is a disobedient figure, Arachne is a boasting figure, and then finally we get Rehoboam and his, it's not his disobeying, but it's just his prideful stance. And we should contrast Rehoboam right here with Trajan and the widow. Rehoboam hears the tax revolt and just goes running away, as opposed to Trajan, who actually deals with the widow in that intaglio back in Canto 10. So there are callbacks to the intaglios. There are all kinds of strange little intersections here amongst the pieces. I think Dante is working very hard to weave David through this. Saul, David's own poetry, David's grandson, Rehoboam. He's trying to weave Ovid through this too, and the metamorphoses, all kind of related to art, metamorphoses, the metamorphic nature of art, David as a psalmist, as a poet, as Dante would see him. This is all weaving around this discussion of pride. But there is one strange curiosity in the midst of all of this. Well, I suppose more than one, given that Arachne represents a kind of art and Niobe's turned into art. And we had Apollo earlier. I suppose there's more than one curiosity, but here is the curiosity. Both Saul and Arachne in the middle of this passage are suicides. Saul falls on his sword and kills himself. Arachne hangs herself with the threads of her weaving. And this brings up the problem of Cato. Where is Cato in all of this? There's the suicide who opens up Purgatorio, and yet we have two suicides back to back here. They're put back to back so that they're linked in the passage and so that the passage feels like it has a flow to it, you know, two suicides next to each other at the center of these 12 lines. But at the same time, merely bringing up suicides brings up Cato, which is a problem. Cato, who exploded the notions of the afterlife, who said, well, I guess suicide's not enough to get you in hell. Cato, who himself is a pagan, who is redeemed, unlike poor Virgil. All that suddenly sits here. I don't think Dante means it to sit here, but he should know he's playing with fire. Maybe he does know he's playing with fire by having two suicides here, and that a reader would say, hey, we passed a suicide back there, Cato, and he got through. So what about Arachne? What'd she do? Well, what she did is she challenged Minerva. And this goes back to this problem Dante has. It's a really huge problem. Dante is trying to see Minerva and Niobe and others, Tantalus and others, Titan and Apollo and Diana. He's trying to see these as precursors of Christian revelation. How do you work out classical references inside a Christian poem. There will never be a final answer to this. This is part of what Dante will wrestle with throughout comedy almost to the very end. Maybe when we get to the top, Saint Bernard will have put this whole problem out of the way. But for now, we could say that Dante's notion that the classical world is a precursor of the Christian world is difficult, heretical, non-orthodox, becoming increasingly the truth with the Renaissance. But Dante's on the forefront of it, and he's wrestling with it because it is not as certain as it is once we get up to Leonardo or Michelangelo or further, in which it's rather accepted that the classical world is a precursor of the Christian world. So more about humility. Last time we talked about humility as an emptiness or a lack, and I brought up this whole question of, can you, in fact, build a virtue out of an emptiness, a lack, a do-nothing, a static point? Is that possible in an ethic, since ethics are based on actions and choices? I think this is really important to think about because there is something here that goes on. All these figures of pride are just out of motion or just in motion or just having made a decision or just finished with having made that decision. Humility has to be an action that is not merely self-abasement. I'm anticipating comedy ahead, but here's where Christians try to solve it. The real solution here lies with the concept of love. Because love is an action by its nature, whether that be sexual love, whether that be the love of God, whether that be the love of art, love is a forward-driving action. It is part of the engine of Christianity that it has allowed this concept, love, to become the fundamental nature of action. It is still wrestling, Christianity, with the binary problem of ethics, the do-don't-do problem. And if you set up ethics as do-don't-do, then you make the good the don't-do. And so you make the good an emptiness, a lack, a stasis, just standing there. Love is the answer here. We're going to get to it ahead of us because love is tied in with action-oriented behaviors. Let me give you a personal example here that may blow this out just a little bit. I may have told you this story in pieces before, but I'll tell it to you again. I don't remember what's happened over the years of this podcast, but I'll tell it to you again. So when I was in grad school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and getting my PhD, I ran a book group, and it was a book group for lay people, not for academics. And it was great. I still do this. I still run a book group for lay people. I just did a session this morning online on Annie Ernaux, one of Annie Ernaux's books. Anyway, I ran this book group partly because I just wanted to be reminded that real people read books, not just academics. Real people read Jane Eyre. Real people struggle with Jane Eyre, not just, you know, pointy-headed academics. So I ran this thing for a long time. And one of the people that came to this book group was a Presbyterian minister of a rather liberal Presbyterian church. After he'd been to the book group for a while, he said to me, "I want you to lead the Bible study in my Presbyterian church." And I was like, "Oh, no, dude, you can't. You cannot want the atheist to lead the Bible study every Sunday morning." And he said to me, "I've watched how you handle texts. I've watched the reverence with which you handle texts. And I think you're the perfect person to handle a text because you're not going to grind your own axes over. You're going to treat it like a text and you're going to try to interpret it." So I did. I ended up leading a Bible study in a Presbyterian church for 4 years. Well, the members of this Bible study were much more proactive believers than I was, and they wanted to do good in the community. We approached a mission for homeless men in Madison, Wisconsin, and we said we would love to come in every month or maybe twice a month and make dinner for the men because they, you know, it was a shelter and they came in and they had dinner and then they had a place to spend the night. And we said we wanted to do this. And the director, who was actually very smart, said to me, I approached him, and he said to me, "Yeah, you could do that. You're absolutely, we would love to have your help feeding the men. But here's the thing. For this first 6 months, you cannot feed them in. You just have to come twice a week and eat dinner with them. I have to tell you, this is one of the scariest things I've ever done. To show up at a homeless shelter and just sit down with a bunch of men, my pointy-headed English PhD self, sit down with a bunch of men on the street with other people from my class all together and just eat a meal with these guys, talk to them, find out who they are. And here's what the guy who ran the center said. He said, I don't want you coming in here like the savior, that you come in and you got your tray of lasagna or chicken tetrazzini or whatever between you and the guys, and aren't you benevolent? You get to pass it out, dish it up. You always have the safety of your lasagna or casserole or whatever it is between you and them. And I don't want that. I want you to actually know who they are. And once you know who they are, we can put that lasagna between the two of you and you can hand them a piece of lasagna, but then you're handing it to John or Pete or Bill. You're not just handing it to somebody to make you feel better about being a good, you know, a liberal do-gooder. It was so revelatory. It changed my entire ethics because I realized that there was a way to be actively good, and part of the actively good stance was humility. It was actually putting myself in the place of these guys. That humility wasn't just absence. It was, in fact, human connection. And I think if we take this to Dante and we go back, we could see David leaping around in front of the Ark of the Covenant. And we could see Trajan and the widow bickering between each other. And we can understand that humility isn't just submission. There may be an active component of human and, for Dante, divine connection at the bottom of it that forms the basis of the ethics. So maybe, despite how it's set up on the Terrace of Pride, maybe it's not as binary as it first looks. Here are the humble and here are the proud. Now we're looking at the proud and we're walking on them. Oh, you don't miss the significance of that, right? Walking on top of the proud. But maybe it's not quite as differentiated as we think because Pallas Athena, Apollo, Mars show up, who are not prideful inside these reliefs. And here, Arachne, a voice of art, shows up inside these reliefs. Maybe there's a way in which pride itself is an action, yes, but humility is an action too. And finding that action is fundamental to the creation of art and to finding commonality with the humans around us. Okay, well and enough for this episode of the podcast. We're going to call quits to it and say we got one more set of reliefs to go in this slow walk through them. I realize this is a little tedious because it is kind of tediously done. Now he's just throwing these things out in tercets and three-line segments, and I wanted to really give them their due. So we're treating them seriously. To get to the next installment, you have to subscribe, rate this podcast, do all that kind of stuff you do. Thank you very much for that. I really appreciate it. Writing a review helps me because I am completely unsupported, and I really appreciate the ratings to keep the podcast alive in the algorithms. I hope to connect with you on social media, on Instagram, on Facebook. I hope to connect with you on my website, and otherwise, stick around because we got one more go at these reliefs under our feet in the next episode of Walking with Dante. I'm Mark Scarborough, and I'll see you then.